The following program deals with military and veteran issues. All comments and opinions expressed on this show are those who made them. They do not reflect the opinions of the Church of Satan or Radio Free Satan. So on with the show.
Welcome to the official Inferno Legion podcast for the month of July 2020, the Wicked Warrior episode. We got a fantastic guest coming up here in a little bit. Before we get to that, of course, I want to introduce you to everyone who's here with me today. And that starts with our wonderful co-host, Warlock. Yes, you heard that right. Warlock, Dwayne Burns. Dwayne, congratulations, man. And how the hell are you?
Thank you. I'm good.
Yes, Dwayne is officially a second degree. He's officially a warlock. And, of course, the letter came, what, 2 days after we recorded the last episode?
Something like that, yeah.
So we didn't have a chance to properly congratulate him on that episode. We'll pick up for that here. And, of course, with us is our, I'm going to use the word efficient this week, co-host, Warlock Jeff Ivins. Jeff, how are you, man?
I'm doing good.
All right, fantastic. We also want to give a shout out. Another gentleman that's a Legionnaire got his elevation paperwork after we recorded the last episode. So an official congratulations to now Reverend Dr. Robert Ng for his elevation within the Church of Satan and into the priesthood of Mendes. Congratulations, sir. And if you're listening, cheers. So, anything new going on in your guys' life?
Not a hell of a lot with this fucking COVID going on.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, Florida's kind of getting raped on this stuff.
Oh, I know.
Dropped $1,000 on the air conditioner in the truck, dropped another $400 on the Harley, so I'm dropping money here and there.
Hey, you know he's dropped some money my way.
The Legion takes donations.
Yes. It takes money to do this podcast.
Well, I'm glad you guys are doing good, man. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and get our guest on, our Wicked Warrior for the month of July 2020.
Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah has given unto you these 15... Wait. Ten commandments!
RadioFreeSatan.com.
All right, and we are back here on the official Inferno Legion podcast, the Wicked Warrior of the Month episode for July 2020. And I said in the intro, we've got a very special guest with us. And the reason this guest is so special is not just because he's the Wicked Warrior of the Month or he's an outstanding Legionnaire, but it's because today, at this very moment, July 30th, 2020, when this is being recorded, is his official last day in the Army after a 20-year career. So if you're listening to this, pour yourself a drink and raise it up for this man. We have with us none other than Sergeant First Class, retired David Bradford. David, how the hell are you, man?
I'm doing great. Thank you, man. You honor me, kind sir, for inviting me to the podcast.
Yeah, I couldn't pass up a chance to talk with someone about a career, a full career in the military on the day they retire. I mean, that's just awesome.
Yeah, it is kind of I guess cathartic in a way too for me, you know, to say, hey, guess what happened?
All right, man. So let's talk about your career in the Army because that's what we're here for today. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. Okay. The young lad, David Bradford.
Impressionable David Bradford. Yeah. Actually, you know, David Bradford had no intention of joining the military once, you know, he was done with high school. Young David Bradford was going to live in Southern California in a small town called Norco, and he was going to be a mechanic and live with his uncle for a while until he got his shit together.
But that didn't work out.
That is not, in fact, what would transpire for a young David Bradford. So what ended up happening was my uncle, he ended up getting divorced, and he was going to get foreclosed on. And I was like, well, I could go back to Texas and live with my mom. She doesn't have any room because my brother lived with her. And the same thing with my dad. He lived in San Diego. He didn't have any room down there. So I was like, well, I'm about to be effectively homeless. So I talked to my uncle, who is an Army vet. Most of my family's been in the military, so it was never like it was an option that was, you know, far from, you know, reality. It's just kind of how it goes in military families. I'm sure most of y'all can attest to that. But anyways, so I was forced with the prospect of homelessness and joining the military. And I talked to my uncle, and he told me about EOD. He was like, hey, man, when I was down in Panama, we were going, walking through the jungle, and this fucking guy came up and stopped us. And he's like, hey, there's a missile in the road. So we stopped, and then we saw these guys walk by with big old backpacks on and fucking metal detectors. They walk up there, and they fucking blow up this missile, and then they come back. And he's like, those dudes were the coolest fucking cats I'd ever seen. They were EOD. And he's like, they didn't even look like soldiers. They looked like fucking civilians trying to be soldiers. And I was like, I thought that was like the coolest shit. And then I like looked into it, and I found out what they did. And I, another thing that clicked with me was, and this is all before I even talked to the recruiter, I was like, I did a report in high school on like ordnance in other countries that is blowing kids' arms off and stuff, like Africa, landmines taking off kids' feet, and Vietnam taking off kids' hands for submunitions. And it really made an impact on me to do the research on that and find out, you know, how those kids are hurting and how often that happens and why, you know, just the enemy remnants of war and the landmines, you know, they're always in the ground. They're doing their job. You know, they don't right, discriminate.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of civilians really realize how many munitions are left over in the ground after a war is over. I mean,
bro, like it was okay for us in the DOD to bury ammunition until like 1970 something, and it was just a standard practice. Like,
right.
And records were not really kept that well. Like, they're still digging up, you know, all the time on the East Coast over in Maryland, Edgewood, Aberdeen Proving Ground area. They're always digging up chem rounds from the, you know, turn of the century where we were developing that stuff, and it's a mess.
Yeah.
But yeah, I digress. the whole thing with that and doing the paper on those kids and feeling for them, I was like, fuck, man, that's a real shitty situation. So, I mean, if there's some way I could do something about that, you know, I would do that. And this is pre-September 11th. We're talking early 2000 at this point.
Okay.
Well, actually, I graduated high school in 2000, so this would be like early 2001, like January-ish. Okay. I joined the Army in April of 2001. I was like, yeah, I was into the Army after 8 days after talking to the recruiter. Like,
you were still in AIT when 9/11 happened.
Yeah, I just we were at the last section. Yeah, the last section of ammunition handler school. We were out at the ASP. The day it actually happened, we were out at the ASP. I was cruising around in like this, you know, the variable reach forklifts. Mm-hmm. I think they're like 5K, but they have like the extendo boom that goes like way the hell out, and the crab steering, and like they can do all sorts of weird like levely shit where you can like pick a box of ammunition out of a Connex, you know, stuff like that. But I just pulled up in that thing and I shut it down. I went through the procedure and everybody's like standing talking to the instructor. And I walk over there, and he's like, hey, basically America's under attack. And we're a threat con Delta, so you got to go back, and you're going to your muster point, which is the chow hall right now. So,
wow. Wow.
Get the fuck on the bus. Hurry up. Hurry up. And they, yeah, dude, it was wild, man. They passed out rifles, and there was kids, like, scared as fuck with live ammunition and rifles sitting at the fucking front of our barracks and at the front of the chow hall, and it was madness, man. It was like you're watching the shit over and over on TV, and it's just surreal.
Right. And all of a sudden, you knew you were actually going to have to do your job.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't know. It's like I looked over at my buddies. They're like fucking looking at this chick eat an ice cream cone because they're fucking perverts, and I'm like looking at the television and I'm thinking like these kids don't get it. And I was only 18. I was a kid, and I was thinking to myself, these guys don't get it. I knew right then and there that shit wasn't going to be all right. You know, I had no intention of war. I'm not a war fighter. I'm not a door kicker. You know, I want to go help people. You know, that's not me.
Right.
But unfortunately, that's not what path was chosen for me.
Right.
As we'll get into, yeah.
So let's rewind a little bit before 9/11. You talked to your recruiter, you get in, you said 8 days, so I'm assuming there's no problems with that.
No. I went and told my uncle, and he's like, well, shit, good luck, man. I mean, you didn't have to. And I was like, And I was like, no, fuck it. You know, I'm going to do it. You know, what's the worst that could happen? You know, I get money for college. It wasn't like there was a war or anything going on.
Right. So you get in, you get through your MEPS process and all that stuff, and I'm assuming you didn't have any issue getting the MOS you wanted either, because you're obviously
Man. My recruiter, he didn't even know what it was. He had to look it up. and then he told me, he's like, holy shit. And I was like, what? He's like, yo, if you leave like in 8 days, and he's like crunching on his computer, he's like, if you leave in like 8 days, if you make it through at e-school, you could get $17,000. And I was like, the fuck? Like, my brand new truck cost like 10 grand. I had a brand new Ford Ranger. But it was like, you know, the most basest Ford Ranger on the planet. Right. Vinyl, well,
little
everything.
A year from that date, the bonuses would be through the roof for you.
Oh, I got a pretty hefty bonus. I got plenty of bonus money in my career. Like, I got... No spoilers, but I got a pretty hefty lump sum one time, tax free, and good times. Good times.
All right, so you get to basic training. Everyone knows basic training is a pain in the ass.
Yeah, man.
Was there ever a moment, this is a question I love to ask every Wicked Warrior that comes on here, was there ever a moment during basic training where you were like, I fucked up, I shouldn't be here?
Yeah, it was like, so when we came in, I went to Leonard Wood. I don't know where you guys went, but when we came
in. Lost in the woods.
It was pretty quiet. We had a couple days where they were like, it was sort of military-ish. They made us like do stuff, but we didn't really have uniforms or anything yet. And then once we got like uniforms and stuff, you know, we got in there and then we were all standing in line and they were yelling our name and we were in this building. And when they yelled your name and your social, you were to run out and you were to get on the truck. And we did that, and it was just so eerily quiet. And then, like, the second, like, everybody was on the truck, and then the doors closed, it was just, like, an explosion of fucking hatred. And, like, that was, like, the moment that I was, like, that was the, oh. And with that moment, he knew. He fucked up.
Right.
Yeah, it was, like, the record scratch. I guess I'm wondering why I found myself like this. You know, like, but yeah, it was pretty intense, you know, and I even kind of knew what to expect because I had a lot of military in my family, like, but there's not much that can prepare you for, you know, that onslaught.
The moment. Yeah. The moment's always worse mentally than people could ever prepare you for.
Oh, and it just fucking went on. And they just like kept coming at us, dude, for the whole damn day. All night, too. And it was probably, they let up on us about like 1 in the morning. And then, you know, of course, they had us up at 4:30 the next morning.
Right.
This is what we do every day now. Ready, go.
All right. Yeah. So we're moving on. We talked about 9/11 happens while you're in AIT. I'm guessing it was somewhat close to the end of your AIT.
Yeah, real close to the end. So I left. So my AIT, after basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, I went down to Huntsville to Redstone Arsenal. And I love that base, by the way. It's a very nice base, very nice area. So Huntsville, Redstone Arsenal was the AIT for the ammunition handler. And so I went through that course. I graduated basic training right around 4th of July. Like our little family weekend was like on 4th of July is how it worked out.
So, 4th of July in a military town. That's got to be fun.
Yeah, dude, we sat in the bed of my mom's pickup truck and we watched fireworks, you know, just right there from the base, like in one of the parking lots on base. It was pretty dope.
4th of July in an EOD town.
Yeah. I didn't think about that.
Exactly. But where was I going with that?
So you finished ammunition handler.
Yeah. Okay, so I was giving you dates. Yeah, so 4th of July, I go down to Redstone Arsenal, like, shortly after 4th of July. I do AIT down there, which ends around, like, September 25th. And that's when I PCS to Eglin Air Force Base, Florida, which is right around Destin, Fort Walton Beach area. Fucking beautiful, beautiful area down there.
There's a lot of Army at Eglin. for it being an Air Force base.
That they're all EOD, dude. There's a shit ton of EOD there. That's where
school. Yeah, they got EOD. They've got the special operator pilots. Oh,
that's right. To seventh group now. All of seventh group lives down, and the Rangers come to Hurlburt Field. And I forgot about all that. Yeah, I did. I worked with seventh group. I love those guys. Like, I still talk to a couple of them.
Seventh group used to be up at Eustis, didn't they?
I think back in the day,
their transportation.
They were out of before Eglin. I think they were out of Florida. I think they were in Tampa for some reason. I want to say
Well, I know battalions are stationed in different places.
But now they're headquartered there at Eglin. So.
So what was your first? Yeah, you said your first duty station was Eglin. What was your first unit?
Oh, actually, so after EOD school finished in, so this would have been like, oh wow, I graduated in May, mid May. So like towards the end of June, I PCS'd to Weijongbu Camp Red Cloud, Korea. So that was my first duty assignment.
Hardship.
I was crushed, man. They're like, okay, put on the wish list where you want to go. I'm like, Fort Rosecrans, San Diego, because that was an EOD position. I was like, okay, we're going to get, okay, Fort Irwin, fuck it. You know, I can go there. I can still drive home.
You had to have Europe. Everyone has Europe.
Yeah. And I had Germany and Alaska. And I was like, fuck yeah, I would love to go to either one of those places. Nah, dude.
Hang on a minute.
Yeah. I should have wrote on there anywhere but Korea. Oh no, send his ass to Korea. Fuck him. And I was like, I should have known right then that's how this was going to be. You know, like that was fucking. I should have known. Yeah.
Between the wake up call of basic training, then 9/11, then getting stationed in Korea. I mean, you knew your military career was going to be.
This is so bad. This is so bad. Is this bad?
So you're in Korea.
Before we even get into
everything crushed. That happens to you in Korea, got to talk about your very first Thunder Run.
My what?
Your very first Thunder Run.
Oh, dude. Oh, I don't remember a lot of it, but I'll tell you what I can remember.
Nobody remembers a lot of it.
All right. And, you know, mind you, this is like 20 years ago, too, man. And I've been blown up a number of times.
Right.
We don't even really know, like the science isn't really completely done on how that affects your brain tissue, you know, specifically. Like,
well, the science may not be complete, but I can tell you with some authority that it fucks it up.
Yeah. I don't think I think it puts scar tissue in your brain, and I don't think brain scar tissue functions like normal brain tissue. So you have to figure out a way around it. That's really? Kind of like, that's what I think. And, you know, just like with explosive waves, like when it propagates, there's a very sharp positive pressure spike, which is the blast wave itself, and then a very sharp decline, and then like kind of a slower negative pressure phase. So you crush something down, then you expand it beyond, and then you put it back to normal, all within, you know, a few milliseconds. So what does that do over and over and over? You know, not necessarily shots like I'm saying that knock you back or, you know, not ring your bell, like, or make, you know, you get hit so hard your teeth click, you know, because that's happened a few times.
Well, we can add TBI to your application.
No, I never got documented, so they said no. I know, it's kind of wild, you know.
Well, we'll get to the VA at the end. We're going back to a still young David Bradford being in Korea.
Okay.
Going
on. Oh, Jesus.
Oh, this should be fun. I've been to Korea, so.
Yeah, all right. So my first day in Weijongbu, I'm greeted at the airport by my buddy. He's dead now, Dan. God rest his soul, Dan Gresham. He was the guy that like took me under his wing, and like when I got to Korea, and he showed me like, "Hey, bud, fucking, you made it, man! Fucking, this is what we bros do." And we went out and we proceeded to fucking Taiwan on like two or three different bars with like drinking girls and like juicy girls just chilling and playing pool and rubbing on you and shit and trying to get you to spend money on them. But like my buddy was telling me the game. He's like, "They're not gonna get you, man. And they were like rounding that. They were like, no, 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 you get off of fucking our buddy here. You know, they were escorting the girls away from me, and there'll be plenty of time for that. Don't you worry. So, you know, we played pool at one place, and we went to another place, and went to another place. And then they're like, hey, we got a surprise for you. And the commander, I forgot to mention, the commander was also there, and first sergeant were also there to greet me at the airport when I showed up. But this is after, you know, the formal introductions, and I got my barracks room, and I signed for my key and all that. I skipped right to the good, interesting part going out. But, like, we go into this one bar, go upstairs, and I'm 19 years old, and I'm already, like, kind of drunk. And this is pretty much one of my first experiences with alcohol, other than, like, AIT, where I got shit-faced on Malibu and orange juice and passed out in a hotel room. But,
so you have... You have a Malibu and orange juice experience, and then you go straight to a Korean Thunder Run.
Yeah, eventually. Yeah, it's trial by fire, you know, to find out. But we go into this bar, and I go up to the bar, and the commander turns around right as I'm walking up, and I lock eyes with the commander, and I'm like, I'm underage, but as far as the Army's concerned, because the drinking age was 20 in Korea, because they were trying to be nice. At the time, because there was some civil unrest because the tank ran over some girls previously, and it was a whole big deal, and there was Molotovs, and we don't talk about it.
Only veterans are flipping about history when it comes to this.
Yeah. but yeah.
So the drinking age in Korea was 20, but in the Army, it's still 21.
Yeah, exactly. I was 19 at the time, and I was drinking. They didn't give a fuck. And I see the commander, and I'm like, oh, well, here it is. I'm fucked. They brought me in here, and now I'm getting Article 15 because I'm obviously drunk. And he's like, he calls me my first name. He's all, Dave, what's up, dude? And I was like, this is weird.
It's a trap. It's a trap.
Yeah. Alarm bell's going off. He's like, I got you a beer.
Not too much, Christopher.
Oh, he was cool, and he was just real welcoming, and he's like, welcome to beer, like, try not to get too fucking hammered. And so we just ended up, we went to like a couple more bars, just, it wasn't like rowdy crazy, just talking to random people, just having drinks at different bars, like random drinks, and it was just me and my buddy Dan, and just all the people, kind of the bartenders that he knew, and we just stayed out all night, just bouncing between bar and bar, and he's like, we'll never get caught, dude. They don't fucking come down here. My buddy Dan, he was half Korean. He fucking spoke a decent amount of Korean. So, like,
so you got lucky on your first
time. I was like the odd man out, but like, yeah, we stayed out, and like, we both fucking end up passing out kind of by the subway station in Wijangbu, and Ajima was like sweeping with her little shitty fucking broom next to us, like telling us to fucking get up and go home, calling us drunk, lazy fuckers. Just, and yeah, that was, we had to like just kind of find somewhere to chill out. So we went back into the subway terminal, and they had these little, like, these little things called manju. Oh, fuck, I love it, dude. It's like little corn cakes, and they have like some kind of custard inside of them. And they, like, fry them in, like, a little waffle iron thing, dude. And they give you a little cup of them. And the custard inside is all warm. And, dude, when you're, like, fucking hungover as shit, they're, like, the best little, like, snack, man.
So, they suck it right up. They really do. Dude,
and you can just, like, go right to bed after that and just sleep.
So like, I assume you spent a year altogether in Korea?
Yeah, I did 1 year in Korea. I got back, and I went to – again, I tried to get San Diego and Fort Irwin, and – I was like, fuck it, I'll even take Fort Lewis, you know, like, please, please, something, anything.
Something on the West Coast.
And then, they're like, so the best we can do is White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico. And I'm like, where the fuck is that? Like, what even is that? Like, that wasn't even on, like, the list of shit that, like, they gave me. Like, so, but it actually turned out to be my favorite duty assignment, though, like, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I met both of my wives there.
Both of them.
I only have one now, though, by the way. Not into the polygamy thing. But
The wrong state. That's the wrong state to have it in.
Yeah. Yeah, South Carolina, they're pretty backwards out here, man. Let me tell you what.
So being at the missile range, you were basically a JRTC every day, huh?
Well, no, it wasn't bad, man. Like, honestly, all we did was we supported the R&D on new different types of ordnance they were developing. And since we were in the middle of a war, money was flowing into that place like
Oh, I bet.
And well, it was as were changes in ammunition.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. And we're like, I worked on all these super awesome projects, dude, that like, so a lot of them actually made it out to field. And it's like, I actually got to put input, you know, scientists came to, once they figured out we were competent and we weren't just like fucking some chuckle-headed grunts that come out, like, they would, they would talk to us and they would ask us questions. They're like, oh shit, you guys are like different from most soldiers we know. And we're like, well, yeah, we're not fucking retards. And they would just be like taken aback, you know, like they're not used to people speaking like that. Like,
we handle explosives for a living.
Yeah, like, hey, look, I still have all my fingers. I'm a good one. Shit's ridiculous, man. But yeah, like, I had a lot of input on a lot of different projects we worked on, like a line of sight anti-tank missile called the LOSAT. It was like, basically, they used parts from an AMRAAM missile to make, like, this fucking Humvee-mounted missile that could shoot, like, 10K in, like, 2 seconds. It was something ridiculous, dude. Like, this missile basically exploded off the top of the Humvee and then hit, like, Mach Jesus within, like a couple milliseconds. So, like, it's cooking.
I'm sure that would have been great for the brain tissue of the gunner.
Oh, God. Yes. You don't want to be in the Humvee when this is happening. So we gave you this cable, and you can stand behind it, preferably behind a wall, too, if you have one. But
that's kind of awesome. So you were basically involved in, like, experiments.
Yeah.
Just experimenting with stuff to see what would work.
There was a fucking tungsten rod in that motherfucker, man. And they were hurling it downrange, like I said, Mach Jesus. And when it would strike an object, it was just moving with such velocity and the density of the tungsten. And the way when tungsten hits something, it does what's called ablates, as opposed to like mushrooming, like traditional bullets. It like shears away at the front and actually becomes sharper. Actually, depleted uranium does that too. It ablates in the front as it penetrates, but it makes a hell of a mess, so we didn't really, you know, you don't do that unless you really need to.
Right, right. Wasn't that kind of work?
It says fire in case of, I've worked with DU rounds because one of the gunners in the tank sliced off the aft cap by, you know, not fully putting it in before shutting the ammunition door. And they have that consumable case, so it's like a fiberboard component, and he sliced it off with a metal door. Just being a typical tanker, just, shut door, crush.
So how long were you out in New Mexico for?
So I was in New Mexico from like August of 2003 to August, let me see, I got to Korea in 2003. So 2003 I got to White Sands, 2003 to 2006. I left White Sands in 2006. And it was like a bunch of stuff that happened to me there. We don't have time to delve into all the crazy stuff, but yeah, I went there, and then I went to a WMD unit that was standing up in – it's called Technical Escort Unit that was in Washington State called the 110th Chemical Battalion. And what we did there –
was that at Fort Lewis? You finally got to go to Fort Lewis?
Yeah, nice. Well, I didn't even get a choice. Like, I assessed for a top-tier unit that – works well. I'm not really supposed to say what they do, but
yeah,
they
don't, do other stuff.
Yeah, don't
violate the OPSEC.
Yeah, no, they do other stuff with certain things, and I assessed for one of those units. There was one that was in the National Capital Region in D.C., and there was another one that was supporting the West Coast, and I assessed, and I was accepted through the rigorous assessment process that they had. And I was accepted to go to the other one that was in Washington, D.C. But
so how does that as assuming – well, obviously because you're still EOD. So you're not an operator, but you're still going through an assessment. What happens if you fail that assessment? Would you just
– you go back to your normal life, man. They're like, yeah. Hey, thanks for trying. You're not what we're looking for. And right. you can fail an assessment for a number of reasons.
But would you still be in that in that base, or was that like you move up?
No, I would PCS to the special unit.
Gotcha.
Like, okay. And you assess for these special units simultaneously, and you can go to one or the other. It's like whoever needs you.
You become needs of the army.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And so they wanted me at the other one. And but what ended up happening was with all this money pouring into like Homeland Security, like they stood up a wing that took over that mission.
Right.
So for the National Capital Region specifically. So that unit that was there ended up being put on the chopping block. So consequently, so did my orders.
Right.
So it's
because that's how that works.
Yeah. I saw like I trained for assessment and like brutalized myself, you know, for months in advance to to get to a point where, and you know, ironically enough, I did it again and was rejected later on in my career. So
because, interesting. Wow. Yeah,
we can talk about that later too. But.
So I'm assuming now that, that you're, you went through this assessment program, whatever, we should be coming up close on your deployment now, huh?
Oh yeah. So I went to the tech escort unit, and I forgot to mention at White Sands that I deployed to Kosovo. That was a whole thing that I never even mentioned. Yeah. So like in 2004 to 2005, I deployed to Camp Bondsteel, Kosovo. Where
those are the good years of Kosovo.
Yeah, man, it was chill, man. The DFAC was nice. We just lifted weights all day and waited for somebody to say we found a bomb or the Polish to come up and say, here's a truck full of bombs we found. Like, right. Oh, fuck, man. Maybe don't, like, drive it up to my gate in this, like, wooden, rickety-ass wooden crate with straw in it. I mean, I know you guys are trying, but damn, bro. Seriously.
I have seen some soldiers do some dumb shit with explosives in the field.
Well, this is fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's hay and bucks.
How many pulls does it take to bring you an EOD truck full of ordnance in Kosovo?
All of them. All they would fucking jingle truck that motherfucker and be hanging off the sides like with their guns at the high ready like they're some kind of hitters, man. And they're all just like basic dudes. There was no rules, man. It was awesome for them.
Right. Well, Kosovo in general is a good deployment. At least it.
Yeah, no, I mean, enjoyed it.
Not back in the 90s, but, you know, anytime after that.
Yeah, we did have a dude get pretty fucked up. My buddy Paul Culkin took a car bomb to the neck on one mission. So, yeah, he got fucked up pretty bad. Lost a piece of his jugular. Like, you know, piece went through his completely through his forearm. Like, just some. He's good, man. He's out of the army. He got out a little while after we got back, but he's still kicking around, man. I talk to him all the time. He's one of my best friends. But yeah, man.
So yeah. So then you're going, and now, if I remember correctly, obviously correct me if I'm wrong. Your first combat deployment was to Afghanistan, right?
Iraq, actually.
Iraq. Okay.
Yeah,
right.
And that was with tech escort. So we had that was a pretty chill deployment, man. Like, so you're probably going to hate me for this, but I'll spill all my fucking bougie secrets about what I was doing on, you know, on Victory Base Camp, Baghdad, Iraq.
I was stationed at Victory too. So
you know Slayer, right?
Yeah.
We were at Slayer on a house right on the lake, man. Like, yeah, nice. The little pool was right across the street from us. And so all we did was chill in this house with, like, marble floors and a big fucking lake window, like, looking over the lake and play Xbox in, like, the main room. And I lived in a room that was off to the side, all marble floors in my room. We had, like, a big-ass shower room in there. And it was, like, it was bougie, man. Apparently it was, like, the old bath party stuff that we were living in. Big, like, ornate, tall oak doors, just like, you're like, this is nice, man. Like, I can deploy. This is a good deployment. But when they figured out there wasn't any WMDs for us to, like, you know, rush off and save the day.
What are you talking
about?
Saddam obviously had WMDs. I mean,
well, he had the ones we sold him. He had the ones we sold him, but he got rid of those. Well, he tried to, but he just made a fucking mess.
Tossed them over at the Kurds, yeah.
There may or may not, I can't either confirm or deny the existence of a bunker that just got the doors pushed dirt in front of it and just everybody said no. Nope. What's going on? Nope. Just don't even, man. So you don't even want to go there. Yeah.
So was it when, like, my unit is out in the field and we run across something suspicious and we give EOD a call. Was it because you hadn't reached a save point that it took you guys so long to come to us?
Oh, man. right, man. So let me tell you, in the heyday, dudes in my profession were running nonstop, man. There just wasn't enough of us to go around. And like 2005 to 2007, so many EOD techs were dying, dude.
Oh, yeah. It was terrible.
And it was a comedy of errors because we did not lower the standard. I'm doing air quotes. I know you can't see me, but we did not lower the standard for EOD school so people could get through. And that definitely had negative, you know, consequences on, you know, and we were just short on team leaders. And like the team leader is the crux of the EOD field. He's the guy on the ground. And we just didn't have the experience because there was also, you got to think, guys were coming up on the end of their enlistments after like the first run in Iraq around 2004, 2005. And they were like, fuck
nope, no armor.
You know, Donald Rumsfeld's telling me, oh, you go to war with the army you have, not the one you fucking want or think you need. Right. Like, no, dude, that's not.
And it wasn't just people that were fed up with the army and everything. It was at that time, all the private companies were standing up too. And they were offering much more pay for what you guys were doing.
They didn't have no rules like we did, man.
Right.
we were hamstrung by safety and ROE most of my deployment. So, I mean, it's just like, I mean, we still got away with shit. Like, I definitely fired pen flares, like, at an unreasonable, you know. I used them for purposes other than signaling and marking.
Certainly. Yeah. I shot a pen flare into an oil a pen flare into an oil field once. That was
congratulations.
That was a mistake.
No.
It looked cool, but it was a mistake.
I shot one into a guy's jacket on a moped. That was fucking hilarious. He crashed hard. I kind of felt a little bad for him, but like I warned him.
Okay, we're gonna pause real quick.
Oh, okay, yeah.
In 1966, Anton LaVey created the Church of Satan, marking the beginning of the Age of Fire and Year One Anno Satanas. In 1969, he published The Satanic Bible, codifying Satanism as a religion, the first time it's been done in human history.
In the name of Satan, ruler of the earth, king of hell, come forth from the pit, bestow the blessings of hell upon us. For we are your children, and we invoke thee this night.
In 2001, I was appointed High Priest of the Church of Satan. In 2007, I published the Satanic Scriptures, further defining and expanding on Satanic philosophy and greater magic ritual.
Hail Satan, full of might!
For the past 50 years, the Church of Satan has stood as the sole organization to define and defend Satanism as a religion. And though pretenders to the infernal throne have come and gone, we have stood the test of time and will into the future. Visit churchofsatan.com for more information and read the Satanic Bible and the Satanic Scriptures. Knowledge is the solution for ignorance. Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
This is Reverend Gene, the host of Vox Satane, exclusively on Radio Free Satan. Join me every week as we indulge in the classical side of music spanning the past 1,000 years. Vox Satane has already featured over 700 composers covering medieval, baroque, classical, romantic, and contemporary music, including chant, choral, opera, keyboard, and orchestral music, with composers ranging from Gluck to Gilmore, Bach to Bellavance, Talis to Taverner, and Paganini to Pärt. Get your weekly recommended dose of classical music right here on Vox Satane, only on Radio Free Satan, with me, Reverend Gene. Hail Satan!
I used to flip through one television station after another, disgusted by what was supposed to pass.
for comedy. Seeing all of those terrible, predictable comedians made me sad, and it made me shake in my seat. I thought it was the early signs of restless leg syndrome combined with clinical depression. So I went to see my doctor. It turned out that I just needed to listen to better comedy. That's when my doctor recommended The Devil's Mischief on Radio Free Satan.
The Devil's Mischief is a one-hour dosage of comedy and novelty that's made for you, not for the masses. After a decade of biased research, The Devil's Mischief has been clinically proven to be effective at inducing laughter and whimsical feelings in many listeners.
I can finally laugh again.
You don't need a prescription to listen to The Devil's Mischief. You don't even need to visit a pharmacy. That's because The Devil's Mischief is not a pill. It's not a syrup. It's not a spray, a cream, or even a suppository. It's a podcast.
All I need is a connection to the internet.
To learn all you need to know to listen to The Devil's Mischief, visit the official website, devilsmischief.com.
Whether you like to listen to podcasts in your web browser, download an episode directly, or subscribe to podcasts with iTunes, The Devil's Mischief can help.
Side effects may include side-splitting, gut-busting, knee slaps, and slapstick. Some listeners have reported being in stitches, with gags, or finding it to be a riot. Do not listen to The Devil's Mischief while drinking a beverage. Ask your doctor if The Devil's Mischief is right for you.
Or don't. Why should you have to pay that stupid copay for a doctor's visit?
Listen to The Devil's Mischief on RadioFreeSatan.com.
Come with me, Warlock Jeff Ivins, for a time trip back to the 1980s on the Metro. I play synth pop and other hits from the decades of indulgence, only on RadioFreeSatan.com.
Attention iTunes users, if you like this show and other programs from Radio Free Satan, then please take a moment to look us up on iTunes to rate and comment on the program. You can also do the same on Stitcher.com. Look up this program on Stitcher.com, rate it, and give us a review. And that's if you like the show, of course, you know, that you want to give it 5 stars and a good review, not, you know, give it 1 star and say a bunch of mean things. But hey, if you want to do that, then I'm sure there are a bunch of Christian podcasts on iTunes that you could do that on. Anyway, thank you for your support of RadioFreeSatan.com. And now back to the program.
All right, welcome back to the official Infernal Legion podcast, Wicked Warrior of the Month for July 2020. We're talking with Sergeant First Class retired David Bradford about his 20-year career in the United States Army. And David, we had just basically finished talking about your deployment in Iraq, your first deployment, which is about at your halfway point in your your first combat deployment, which is about at your halfway point of your career. Knowing you somewhat personally, this is about the point where all the issues that we all kind of go through, especially on deployments and things like that, started kind of affecting your life and affecting your career. So why don't you walk us through like some of the battles you've had with PTSD and things like that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think what a lot of guys that have been through the same, you know, things can empathize with is that as you go through these things, they have little impact at the time, typically. It's not till you get to a place where your op tempo slows down and, you know, you have time to really process everything that went on, you know, when you were over there. And I think it's the same old song and dance, you know, it's so cliche, but it is true that's how it works. It's like, you don't have a problem being over there and doing it because you're out there getting it, you know.
Right, right.
You know, you're in your mind, you're not focused on that. You're focused on survival. You're focused on making sure your kit's good and your guys are protected, and you know.
And it's normal. That's that becomes the new normal.
Mm-hmm. And you get into a routine with that, and then you know, and then all of a sudden it stops, and you go back to this incredibly boring and, you know, reflective space. And that's not always good. You know, it's not always exactly what you need after a lot of, you know, harrowing experiences and, you know, things that, you know, honestly, people should never have to see.
Right.
What
but now, so, like, in the Army, there is a I guess you could say there is a system in place to help soldiers deal with that, but it's largely ignored and or, you know, ridiculed by the culture of the army.
Yeah, there's that. And I would say, like, the system, and this is just my personal experience, sure, I think it's designed to identify the people who do not have a capacity for further service, as right, opposed to actually rehabilitating people who have had some kind of trauma and lasting damage. I think the system as it existed when I was in, what I think really was centered around seeing whether or not you could keep shooting a gun. You know,
right, yeah. And I don't think that's changed much, honestly. I've talked to some new vets that have the same story, you know? So,
and to a point, I can understand it, but, like, it's beyond, you know, there's no humanity in it. It's very callous. It's officious. It's just,
yeah,
it is what it is, man. You know, it's like, oh, can you shoot a gun? Yeah. Can you wear body armor? No. Oh, well, sorry, guy.
Yeah.
We need body armor wearing guys. So
when you first got back, when was the moment you realized that you were having issues?
Oh, man. I just had a lot of anxiety and a lot of anger. And I was just coming off of my divorce, too. Thankfully, my current wife was with me at the time. She was always, you know, a big help. And it was her that she's the one, you know, that has always guided me to the you need to get some help, because I was, you know, drinking quite a bit, as you can imagine. And it's like it just became a thing where it was like, yeah, we're just getting drunk on the weekends and having, you know, watching UFC fights and having a couple beers with the guys. And they just kind of like it devolved into like a habitual situation where,
yeah,
the drinking was just passing me out at night so that I wasn't laying there ruminating over all the things that I've done and seen and heard and felt and saw, and just, you know, that those repetitive nights where you lay in bed and your mind just does not stop.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like an escape from that.
Well, and it's certainly in the, I guess you could say, the world at large, there's the, it's become a little bit of a joke almost, you know. You have things, yeah, like the old saying, you drink like a sailor, you know,
or, yeah, sure,
or whatever. But what people don't realize is that oftentimes when we're drinking like that heavily, and everyone in the military, regardless of branch, at a certain point starts to drink heavily or self-medicate in other ways and whatnot. And a lot of times we're doing it just so we can sleep. It's a gag in society when they look at the military and they're like, oh yeah, those guys can drink you under the table. But oftentimes it's not for a good reason that we can drink you under the table.
Yeah, it's because we've got a lot of practice.
Right.
Yeah. I had to have a lot of practice.
Yeah, you had to keep up, man.
Yeah. I've been. I know. There was a buddy who he was married, and he was drinking. I want to say he was drinking like a 30-pack a day after he'd get off duty, just to go to sleep or whatever. And none of us ever realized there was a problem until he beat his wife.
Yeah, and that's, is that what it was? That was the
at that point. It was when we were like, oh shit, like maybe he shouldn't have been drinking that much.
Yeah,
maybe he had deeper issues. Maybe, you know, whatever. But at that point, it's too late to help him because, you know, how the military is about.
Yeah.
So
the way it kind of worked for me is like the drinking was problem drinking, and like one night I drove home like just wildly under the influence, and it scared the crap out of me. Thank God nothing happened, you know. And that's the last time that had ever happened. For me, I've never done that since. But I got home and I was just like, yeah, this is it. No. And that's when I really was forced to deal with what I was dealing with. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
when I stopped drinking. And then everything kind of like, my anxiety was just, I couldn't even go out in public, dude. It was wild. Like, I was having panic attacks at work. Like, it was just like, I was like a nervous, like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs, to use an old Southern expression. Yeah. And it just felt like that. Like, any little sound out of the ordinary would cause me to, like, flinch or jump or, like, and it's the weirdest shit because you don't really think about why that is. But you spend so long just sitting in the turret of a truck just waiting for shit to pop off.
Right.
Just waiting for something to happen and waiting and waiting, and then, you know.
It's what happens when you're going at 150 miles an hour for a year straight.
Yeah.
And then decide to go 10 miles an hour. Yeah, it's what happens.
And then you're forced to go 10 miles an hour.
Right.
Stop. And then, of course, it doesn't end there because they send you back.
Yeah. Oh, hey, I know you were like over there killing people, but like turn this shit off now. Okay.
Right. Well, I mean,
not you're cool over here, man.
And you've got to adjust to civilian normal, even though you're still in the military. You still got to adjust to like civilian life. And then they turn around and they give you orders to deploy again.
Yeah. So, yeah, and that's how it was for me, man. Once I know, like, my early career, the first half of my career was pretty light on the deployments, you know, even though, you know, everything started towards the beginning. But at the end, that's when I really started hitting it, man. After Iraq, I came back and I had, like, I was out the door again in 2011. Like, I came back in 2010 and, like, late 2011, I was out the door again. And then after that, in 2011, 2012, I was there and then in Afghanistan, and then we came back. I had like 12 to 13, and then we deployed again in September of 13 to 14. And then after that, that was the SF deployment. That was the, like, the maraschino cherry on top of the ice cream, man. It was the best of times. You live great, but you fight hard. I like to say, like, that Charles Dickens book, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times.
Right.
that really sums it up.
How did going from a year, a little bit more than a year, it sounds like, in Iraq, to civilian life, then going to Afghanistan, how did that differ for you?
You can't really fix anything in a year. You can't really, like, recover in a year, per se, you know, like, that's not enough time, especially when you never get to leave the mindset because you're always training for the next.
Yeah.
You're always, what's the next fight? So, like, you never break out of it. So for me, it just became my life. I wrote a poem a while back that captures a lot of that, like a lot of how I felt. If I can find it, I'll read it to you guys if time permitting.
Yeah.
But, it just kind of, like, it was just too much, man.
Let's shift gears and talk more, like, I guess you could say practical.
Yeah.
About the military in general. What did you experience coming back from Iraq, then your training for your next deployment, and your next deployment is to Afghanistan? A lot of people think that Iraq and Afghanistan, oh, it's the Middle East, it's all the same.
It's wildly different. Wildly different. So most of what I did in Iraq was vehicle mounted, heavy operations, you know, urban type, and that was, you know, the terrain there. And in Afghanistan, it was mountainous valleys, it was river valleys, it was orchards, you know.
A lot of foot patrol.
I spent a lot of time in these little Karez systems, which were like underground little aqueduct kind of situations that they, you know, create for, you know, water irrigation and stuff. And I searched in a lot of those and found a lot of explosives and bed down locations and a lot of other unsavory things. And, you know, it's like, I guess I was the smallest guy, dude. I stand a tall 5'5". I'm like 150 pounds.
So they see a hole, they're just shoving
it. Yeah, they're like, Bradford, what? Get in the hole.
Fuck. Well, that's what they did in Vietnam. The shortest guy became the tunnel rat.
And that's exactly what they did to me, man. It was legit flashlight and pistol fucking crawling in a hole. I'm like, God damn it, I hope I don't see nobody. The only time they ever ran into anybody was after I hurt my ankle jumping off a fucking guard tower because I almost got shot by a recoilless round. That was a funny story, but how do you want to talk? Do you want me to like go through both of the deployments, or like do you want me
I'm just I'm really curious about how like, is I don't know how it is for EOD. I know for me that I was on the ground and I did patrols every day. That was basically my job in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So I was out among the locals every single day, learning their culture, eating their food, trying to pick up bits and pieces of their language and whatnot. And then in Afghanistan, I was artillery, so I actually did my job in Afghanistan.
Yeah, you were shooting.
Lightening. And it was it was a very different experience for me. Not just my job, but then the locals. The locals were different people. They weren't the same people as in Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole different sentiment there.
And you know, as well as anybody, if you're going outside the wire, and you have to deal with the locals, and if you're dealing with the locals, you have to understand their culture. Mm-hmm. So how much of a culture shock was it for you to go from Iraq to American civilian world to Afghanistan?
I didn't have a lot of interaction with the people in Iraq. It was largely just responding to IEDs. And we would drive up. I would meet the security guy. He'd be like, yep, it's 300 meters that way. Okay, cool. Kick the robot out, drive it down. Oh, yep. You know, EFP array. Fucking third one. Third one today. You know, it's just so it just became a routine, you know, for me.
Yeah. So what, in your mind, based on your experience, and obviously I'm not asking you to tell a story for the entire world, but do you feel that Afghanistan or Iraq was a harder deployment?
I think Afghanistan was a harder deployment for me. And I think it's just because the nature of the conflict during the time period. Because I was in at the tail end of Iraq, Operation, I guess I would be the last Operation OIF, the last of OIF into New Dawn. I guess that was the time period for which I served.
So a lot of the combat was drawing down. There wasn't a lot of combat.
Yeah, no, I didn't see a lot of direct combat. What I saw mostly was post-blast investigation and you know, you can imagine the chaos in a crowded marketplace when, you know, six South African 155s in a panel van go off.
It's
pretty, pretty feels bad, man. Feels bad.
Chaotic doesn't seem like an appropriate word.
It's just people parts, dude. It looks like somebody just confettied a fucking stack of people. I hate to be so cavalier about it, but that's the only way I can. Dude, the amount of bodies that I've seen, I don't know. Like, I guess probably people who work in a morgue have seen more dead people than me. But, like, if I had to guess, you know, like, you know, probably, you know, just an insane amount of just gore that I don't know. It's not really so much that affects me. Sometimes it does, but there's other.
I think stuff like that, even if you don't dwell on it, even if you don't see it every night in your dreams or whatever, it still has an impact.
Yeah, I think what fucks me up the most is the feelings that I felt during some of the situations there, you know, like actually watching a dude like die, like that kind of fucks with you. Like it's not when the soul leaves the body, obviously, like, okay, here you go. Scientist Dave will kick in. It's when the DMT hit rolls over your brain, when your body, your body realizes that, oh shit, I'm dying. So this is the point where we trip balls and go hang out with Mr. Comfortable. So, but yeah, you see that happening. And I mean, I don't know. There's probably people out there that won't do something to, but I'm not. I don't know, man.
I think there is certainly a percentage, let's say a percentage of the population that wouldn't affect. But that percentage is way too small for a standing army.
That shit makes me sad. You know, like actually that shit makes me sad. To this day, to watch this, and he was like a 19-year-old kid, man. Holy fuck!
Yeah,
like all I could think about.
You gotta realize the difference too is that the Afghans, they just came off of a 10-year war with Russia.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
they're a totalitarian controlled government with the Taliban,
absolutely.
And then American invasion. Yeah,
they've just been brutalized for centuries. It seems like at this point. Yeah. You know, with all the armies of occupation that have attempted Afghanistan. There's been, you know, volumes of that, you know, history that you could read, and it's just wild. But yeah, I did try to learn and appreciate the Afghan culture. I picked up a few phrases in Pashtun because that was the language that was spoken. Both of my deployments were in RC South, pretty close to Kandahar. There was a small place called Camp Nathan Smith where I was stationed for my first deployment. I was primarily based there. My first Afghan deployment, I was primarily based there, but most of my teams were pushed out to different COPs around the AOs because we fragged out our teams from the main base. And then I would circulate as a platoon sergeant because I had three teams. I would circulate between teams and just run with them as like an extra dude, so that team leader could like get some downtime or, you know.
Okay, so you're basically like you're basically letting a team leader take a break and
I would run missions for him for like a couple days or just, you know, something. You know, and it was good because his guys would trust me to operate, obviously, because I was the platoon daddy, and we had been together for a long time. We trained together, and they knew me, and they operated with me. So they're like, "Yeah, fuck yeah, come down." Like, love that. Yeah, we'll pretend to get drunk off near beers, and we'll play Minecraft or something.
You know what when you've been rocking hard for like, you know, months on end. And you get a couple of near beers and like a movie that everyone wants to watch from the bazaar. Yeah. And you really do feel drunk, even though you're not. Yeah.
Oh, we smoked the hell out of some hookah too. I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I loved hookah, dude. That's I wish I was still had one, man. I'd probably be smoking it right now. But okay. But yeah. Right,
at this point, I mean, we're talking about you're about. What, three quarters of your way through your career?
Yeah, so that was the first Afghan deployment, was me being a plat daddy, just running missions with my teams for my dudes, just whenever they needed a break, like I said. And that was like a standard conventional EOD deployment. So after that deployment was the next one, which is like, it wasn't even like a year, maybe 13 months later. So I got back in 2012, and then 2013 I was pushing out, like September. I got back in like May of 2012, and I was pushing out in like September.
And where was this one going to?
2013. Afghanistan again, yeah. And the lead-up time, we were training for a Kuwait deployment. So I thought...
that would have been nice.
Yeah, I was thinking, dude, I'll get some school done. I'll get college knocked out. Like, I'll finish my associates. I'll go ride a jet ski in the Persian Gulf on R&R again. That was dope.
Right. You guys probably would have been at Camp Doha.
Yeah, I don't know. I've been chilling, getting the two beers a day or whatever you're allowed, even, you know. So, yeah, exactly. But
but it was not in the cards for you.
Yeah, and again, the big green weenie decided to rear its ugly pee hole. And find its way inside me. But,
that's a colorful way of saying getting fucked by the army.
Yeah. Well, people don't understand about Uncle Sam is that he's a sadist.
Yeah. Right? He is.
So his condoms, he puts a condom on because he cares about, he doesn't want you to get an STD, but it's a condom that has sandpaper wrapped around the outside. Yeah.
He's the fucking hand sanitizer for lube because he's a piece of shit.
Hand sanitizer? How about fucking Vicks that you rub all over your chest?
Oh, god damn it.
Icy hot. No, something even worse. Black shoe polish.
Black shoe polish is lube.
Yeah. Oh,
taking me back, man, when I used to just shine boots.
Oh, you'd shine your boot, all right.
So let's jump ahead real quick. And I hate cutting you off because I love hearing, you know, our Wicked Warrior stories. But, you know, we do have to keep it somewhere. Let's jump ahead towards the end of your career. You were medically retired for PTSD.
Yeah.
Mind you, we're talking like a cunt hair before you would have hit your 20. So it's still 20.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
What was the med board process like?
Okay, well, I kind of had a breakdown. There was some stuff that, you know, had gone on in my life that, you know, threw me for a loop. And I kind of had a breakdown and was having some suicidal ideations. And, like, I wasn't seeing anybody, and I hadn't been seeing any counselors since I had PCS the last time. So it had been, like, maybe, like, a year and a half. And I was just trying to go in on my own, you know, just trying to like, I hadn't received any meaningful help my whole time in the Army. Like I said, it seemed a lot more centered on, can you still do what you're doing? Okay, well then why are you here? You know, it seemed a lot more like that. Like I just like, where was I going? I'm sorry.
The med board process.
Right? Yeah. Oh, med board process. So yeah, sorry, man. Sometimes I just totally blank out. Like.
It's probably. All good, man. It's your show, like I said.
It happens to me 5 minutes in the show.
It has nothing to do with repeated blast exposure.
Jeff Bowling will say, introduce us and say, and go ahead, Dwayne, tell us how what's going on. And I'll go, duh.
And he does it. And he does that in person, too, when you start talking to him, like it would when we were Devil's Reign. He'd just wander off into the left field.
People wonder why the retirement time is 20 years in the military. Dude, it's
a hell of a road, man. It's a long way. You don't realize it.
Yeah. So obviously, if you're medically retired, you haven't...
Yeah, okay. So I went... Oh, dude, it was a whole deal. So once I told them I had suicidal ideations, they put me in, like, this place in Colombia called Three Rivers, and it was like mostly people who were addicted to drugs and needed to be clean. So it was really not a good situation for me to be. And like they're trying to like talk you off a ledge and teach you like these coping skills, and it's like I tried to roll this guy over one time with a rope because he got hit by a hellfire, but he kind of caught on fire a little bit, so when I pulled the rope, his whole like bicep slid up into his shoulder and neck meat, and I couldn't get my rope back.
What am I supposed to do with that? Tell me more about stealing a lawnmower for heroin money, shit.
Yeah. What do I... Oh, you didn't have your money for your Suboxone subscription? That's so sad. I empathize with you. I see you and I hear you.
Yeah. And I laugh because I've been in those situations.
I didn't do that, though.
Anything, but I've attended meetings and stuff like that, and I listen to people talk. And I understand that everyone is an individual and everyone interprets... events in their life in different ways, but I listen to some civilians bitch about their problems and I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, dude.
I mean, it's not like
I didn't have an outburst like I described. Yeah. Obviously I was like, you know, I felt like me being there was doing more for the people around me than I was anything was happening for me. And like, I don't know, they kind of
to an extent, I'm assuming that probably felt good, but it didn't really do much.
No, I mean, like, you know, like people tell me I'm charismatic, but like I'm not. I don't like to be in leadership roles. I don't desire that kind of responsibility. That's like not my. I'm more of a like I'm like the gray man, you know. I just want to be the gray man, dude. Just like in behind the scenes, totally clutch, but nobody really even knows who he is. Just like living in relative obscurity. I know that's like kind of, I guess, what's the word, antithetical to Satanism, I guess.
Not necessarily.
A little bit. But like, it's what gets me by, you know what I mean? And it's like, I don't...
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about Satanism.
Sure.
At some point, and I want you to tell us when it was and all that stuff, but at some point you stumbled across the Satanic Bible.
So it's embarrassing, but... I mean, I will divulge. So I was watching this show called Silicon Valley. Maybe you've heard of it.
Yeah.
There's a character on there, and his name is Guilfoyle. And he struck a chord with my heart. And one of the episodes, he talks about how one of the guys is like, your Judeo-Christian upbringing makes you uncomfortable with untruth. And he's like, and he goes into how he's a Satanist. And then I was like, wait a minute. You know, like Satanist to me is this Baptist kid that I was raised Baptist, were the guys who are worshiping the devil under the bridge and sacrificing animals and like painting pentagrams and like stuff like that's what I was always told.
All the satanic
pain. Yeah. I mean, I figured out pretty quick that religion was bullshit, like probably like 14. That's about the moment I was like, this shit doesn't jive, man. So, I mean, you guys can do that. I'm just going to do my own thing. You know, I just didn't really give much thought to the possibility of an afterlife. It's like not a concern. Like, I got too much shit here I'm dealing with. Like, whatever.
which in and of itself is kind of a satanic ideology.
Yeah. Are you bored? Like, what? Like, but yeah, I mean, I figure out pretty much what it is. Like, why does God need so much money? Why does he need such a nice house? Fuck.
how did you find out about the Bible? Like, how did you order the
Satanic Bible? Oh, yeah. So he, Guilfoyle talked about it, and then I went on the internet and I read the Satanic Rules of the Earth, and I was like, oh, this is pretty fucking intriguing. You know, and so I found a Satanic Bible on Amazon, and I ordered it. And I read it, and I was like, it just kind of really resonated with me, a lot of the stuff in there. Like, I could really see where, you know, LaVey was going, you know, with what he was describing. Like, it made a lot of sense, you know, and I liked his style too, like the way the kind of like, fuck you if you don't like it, kind of like, you know, this is what we are, you know, and I hope you fucking don't like me. I don't fucking want you around me, you know, like, I fucking like that. Like,
especially in his later writings. He definitely became misanthropic in his
later. Oh, man. And that just, I think life does that to you. Just in,
yeah.
I mean, certainly I can, from anecdotal evidence, agree that the older I get, the more misanthropic I become. Just certainly, the more I just despise people, dude, just in general.
I think anybody who has I guess you could say a harsh outlook on life.
Yeah.
Develops that, like you said, with age. And I think that veterans probably develop that faster than most.
Jaded,
because we're forced into situations to see the worst of humanity on a near daily basis.
Yeah. How can you laugh at that guy getting his head cut off? I don't know. I really like the fist.
Because if I don't laugh,
guy
I'll
I've
go
seen
insane.
Get his head cut off. Because if I don't laugh, they'll come take me away.
So how did when you discovered Satanism, and I know from talks we've had this was later in your military career, how did that start impacting your view of
Yeah. So, you know, I read into the philosophy and I'm just like, oh yeah, you know, we are just kind of fucking animals trying to figure shit out. Mm. You know? And then he talked a lot about like keeping your mind pure to avoid like substances like alcohol and stuff. And I thought there was a lot for me at the time. There was a lot of weight for that. And it was a way for me to like tone down the drinking and like try to, you know, recenter myself and focus on like my physical fitness and like, fuck, I want to be alive to live. You know, there's shit I want to do, man. Like the vital existence is what I'm going to chase. You know, I was thinking, you know, the first phaser in me is like, yeah, the black flame is burning, bud.
Like horns and tongues.
Yeah.
And
hail Satan, brother. I'm fucking ready, man. I love it. You know, I love the philosophy and the aesthetic to me is pleasing. You know, I like the kind of gothic, the dark, the Victorian, like that sort of stuff. And, you know, just everything about it just kind of clicks, you know.
And that's, you know, and that's what we hear from, I think all three of us would agree with you, but I also, that's what we hear from every, you know, wicked warrior that we have on is when they talk about the Satanic Bible and reading it, and it's just, it's like they're looking at themselves.
Yeah. And yes. I had that feeling.
It's such a weird, like, it really, for me, it was especially weird because I had been actively developing my own philosophy. I'd been writing, I still have journals from when I was 13, 14 years old about like philosophical principles I was writing down that I had figured out on my own. And then I read the Satanic Bible and I'm like, what, that's it. That's what I've been writing down.
Hey, I'm
like,
writing. You
know, obviously worded differently and whatnot, it was the same mindset. I was like, holy shit.
There was a lot of times reading the Satanic Bible, I was like, fuck, I think I've said that.
Right.
Well, what's really bad is when you're sitting in a pitch black, dark room staring at a mirror and somebody turns on the light and you look at the guy and you say, hey, who the fuck are you? Hey, I like you. that's about what it was for me.
It makes perfect sense. And I think that then it's just like being a veteran, you know, when you're having a bad day, and we all have bad days,
you have
a list of numbers, people you served with or people that you've met afterward, like
where
you can give them a call. And the Satanic Bible kind of served that purpose too for me, because when I read it, it was like, I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm an individual. I love my life and I build it according to my own terms. But it's nice knowing I'm not the only person who views life like that.
Sure. I mean, I understand that the Church of Satan is not based on fellowship. That's not even a principle that we have. But just by, you know, the principle of like stratification, like people who think alike are going to come together, you know, just naturally.
Certainly,
I think,
yeah.
You know, definitely. And they're going to build their tribe. It's just how it is. It's how
we are definitely a tribal species. And
absolutely, man.
All right, so here we are 20 years later. Looking back on your career, I know you've had some ups and some downs.
Oh, man.
But Is there anything you change? Besides, obviously, like losing your battle buddy. So
if I could go back and put myself in so many people's shoes, I would.
Right. But aside from that, is there
anything aside from that whole sad part? I don't think that there is much I would change, man. It was a really wonderful overall experience. I like you said, ups and downs, but like it gave me so much. And like where I came from, I was about to be homeless, and now I have a lot to show for it. I have a house, I have a truck, I have a nice bike, I have a bunch of worldly goods that make me happy, and I can take my boys out, and on the boat and shit, and it just we have a good day. I have a good life. Yeah. I have a good life, man. And now, right now, currently, I'm going through a tight spot because I neglected to inform. I guess maybe my fault, but they hold your pay on your last paycheck for like 20 days.
Yeah,
and I wasn't planning on that, so yeah, that's kind of a bump. But I mean, I have money in savings. It just like kind of pisses me off. It's like, yeah, one final little poke with the green dick.
Yeah. Yeah. Uncle Sam's got to get you. He's got to get you.
One last little fucking.
So now you're sitting down. We talked about it before. You're going to enjoy retired life for a little bit, but you are planning on reentering the job market. Are you going to keep doing EOD, but just
in a second? Oh, hell no, man.
What's next for David Bradford?
Oh man, I didn't really plan on like surviving this long, to be honest. So like I'm kind of like just doing it on the fly. I picked up a couple IT certs, Security Plus and A Plus, and that's going to get my foot in the door here in an IT capacity at the very building that I was working in. So I already know the good old revolving door, dude.
Yeah.
I know a lot of the people over there already, so I don't need anybody to vouch for me. And, they know the quality of my work. And I was already pretty much doing the job because my replacement had already showed up and was doing my job. So I was jobless while I was med boarding. So all I did was take care of all the computers in our section.
Nice.
And, so I actually helped us. We, had modernization upgrades. We did all new terminals. I built all those, ran all the cables, ran all the, I didn't do all the back end shit, but I set up all the Ethernet in the office and all the fiber, all the media converters, because some of our stuff came in on fiber but needed to be Ethernet. There was VoIP phones, all that crap. And that was all shit that the G6 was going to have to
do. Gotta love the U.S. government and their behind-the-time strategies.
Exactly. And that was all shit that G6 was going to do, and that's where I'm going to work is in the G6. And I did them a huge solid by taking care of my whole directorate. So, that was a huge – it was me calling in that favor now. Oh, hey, you got an open position there. Remember that time I did all that work for you guys and you guys didn't have to do it? Because you're lazy and you never put it anyways. Yeah. So
are you ready for that? Are you ready for the stupidity of civilians?
I don't know, man. Probably not. If I'm being perfectly honest, but we'll see. It won't be 100%. Civilian. I'm working in a secured building with sure. You can't even take your phone in there. It's a skiff essentially. So.
Right.
Got to leverage that old security clearance while I still can.
I know all about security clearances.
Oh, yeah. Then.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's awesome, man. I'm beyond happy that you could come on here and tell us about your career and on your last day in the Army. It's awesome, man. And you've had quite a fucking ride.
I have, dude. There's so many stories that we could go. I could talk for hours, man. And some of them I want to tell, and some of them I need to tell,
Certainly, yeah. No, I totally understand that. Totally understand.
Well, but there's been vets that have been on here multiple times, so talking to you, you're welcome to come back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, certainly, man. We'll had a great time. Have you back to tell specific stories and stuff like that.
We should have a war story day where everybody's
reveling. That's actually not a bad idea. We might have to.
Yeah. We'll call it the fucking war room, dude.
We'll call it the canteen. But David, first and foremost, congratulations.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Super stoked for you. Super proud for you. Yeah. And thank you so much for coming on this podcast and telling at least some of your story.
Oh, thank you guys for the invite, and I hope, you know, I didn't, you know, I wasn't a total fool. You know?
No, that's Dwayne's job. You're fine.
That's my job.
The comic relief, thank God.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. And, you know, hail to our Wicked Warrior of the Month, David Bradford, Sergeant First Class, retired today from the United States Army. That's fantastic. And until next month, when we bring back our Sinister Scuttlebutt episode, we've enjoyed having you. And hail Satan.
Yeah, hail Satan. Hail yourself. You know?
Hail Satan.
Some ham for us.
Veteran Suicide Hotline. Phone number is 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-TALK. And as soon as you dial that, you press number 1. Also, you can text to 838-255 for more information. But it is just as effective as chat. Support is free, confidential, and available 24/7. It is available to all servicemen and women, active and inactive, guard or reserve, and available to veterans, family members as well.